Hello, everybody. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to be here bringing you today's webinar on a new FDCPA ruling that greenlights email. A second email case makes it clear that collection agencies can email the validation notice in the body of an email. And I'm excited to bring you a panel. We're going to discuss this case and more as it relates to email and the FDCPA today. But first, let me take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the Army industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the Army industry. The site is free for anyone to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it's got to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Kelly Knepper-Stevens is Vice President of Legal and Compliance and the Associate General Counsel for True Accord. Her work focuses on government regulation, compliance, and civil litigation. Kelly serves on the Board of Directors for the Receivables Management Association International and is an ACA certified instructor. She also served as a small entity representative for the arbitration and debt collection rulemakings from the CFPB. Her podcast, Two Dedicated Attorneys, with our fellow panelist Nicole Strickler, can be found on Podbean and on AccountsRecovery.net. Leah Strickland is a partner at Solomon Ward, Siderworm & Smith. Her practice focuses on business litigation, employment litigation, and intellectual property disputes, and she has substantial experience in defending against claims under the state and federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. She advises individuals and businesses in resolving disputes prior to the commencement of litigation and represents clients after litigation has begun in both federal and state court actions. Nicole Strickler focuses her practice in the defense of consumer litigation, including the FDCPA, FCRA, TCPA, and Illinois Collection Agency Act. Her clients include corporations, lending institutions, collection agencies, asset purchasers, lawyers, as well as individuals. She's an active member of ACA International, the Consumer Financial Division of the American Bar Association, and holds a position on the Board of Directors for NARCA, the National Creditors Bar Association. The format for today's webinar is going to be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to ask questions, and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing. To submit a question, you can do it in one of two ways, either hit the Q&A button on your Zoom webinar control panel or type it in through the chat module. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available in the coming days on AccountsRecovery.net. Finally, to make sure nobody gets in any trouble, let me read the following disclaimer. This presentation is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Legal advice must be tailored to the specific circumstances of each case. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area. It should never be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. With that, I'm going to hand this discussion over to Kelly Knepper-Stevens to kick it off. Kelly.
Thank you, Mike Gibb, and thank you for hosting this webinar. Thanks, Nicole, for agreeing to join Leah and I. Leah and I had a lot of fun litigating the Green case, especially with the result that came out this Tuesday. So, and I have to tell everyone here, I was so excited, not simply because of the result itself, but the court, we only just submitted the last briefs last Tuesday. So the court clearly knew what he was going to do and filed this brief in record time, in my opinion. I have other cases that I've been waiting on decisions for over a year now. So it was pretty great to get the results that we did so quickly after the briefing in this matter. So let's get started talking about the case. What happened was Mrs. Green, in her kitchen with her computer, opened up her email that she got from True Accord Corp. We've been playing a lot of Clue. Maybe you have too. So there's my Clue reference for today. And when she opened the email, she decided to go ahead and sue True Accord. Either she felt that since she did not consent to receive emails from True Accord, that was a problem. So the primary theory was that she had to consent before we could send her the validation notice, which is that information that you are required to provide as a debt collector to a consumer either in the initial communication or within 5 days of the initial communication in writing to the consumer about how they can dispute the debt. So that was the initial claim. And then they went ahead and amended the lawsuit to add a claim of overshadowing. And that was because during the validation period, as she alleged in her complaint, she received around six personal emails that she felt overshadowed her validation notice. So let's talk about the details of this case. So we're going to cover eSign. We're going to cover the FDCPA and emailing and sending validation. We're going to talk about overshadowing, and we're going to talk about my favorite claims that are not discussed whatsoever in the opinion of the judge, which includes whether or not the FDCPA violates the First Amendment. So please stay tuned. All of you, thank you so much for tuning in on your Memorial Day weekend kickoff. I can hear somebody is mowing their lawn, so that's pretty exciting. So anyways, let's get into the question of validation. So the judge essentially held that you do not have to consent to receive the initial communication containing the validation notice in the body. eSign does not apply to an validation notice that comes in the initial communication in the body of an email. And so one of the things that he talked about was the subject line. Because the plaintiff claimed that the subject line, which in this case said, you know, important information, something similar to that, you know, didn't indicate that it was about a debt. Well, the court said, you know, that would be a different issue that would be a very relevant factor for me to consider if she had not opened the email. But since she opened the email, what the subject line said doesn't really matter because she opened it and received the notice. But so this means that for anyone out there who is using their initial communication email validation notice inside the body of the email, that you should consider what your subject line says. So I want to know from our esteemed lawyer panelists here what you would recommend for folks using email to deliver the validation notice in the body of the email to put as the subject line.
So that's a good question. And I think the answer will really depend upon whether or not we ever get those debt collection regulations officially from the CFPB, because we know what they want it to say, which is the name of the creditor to who the debt is owed, and then one other piece of account information, right? So not the amount, but they want something like that would allow the consumer to identify the purpose of the message, basically. So for example, you know, the name of the merchant, maybe the name of the original creditor, something that's, you know, referencing the type of the debt, perhaps, something that is gonna let the consumer know what the email is about itself. Now, I thought it was interesting that he, And perhaps, and you know, maybe Leah can opine on this better because she wrote, you know, you guys wrote the briefs and whatnot, but, you know, I was a little surprised that he was really focused on that at all, because, I mean, there is no current requirement, right, that exists. We have what the CFPB wants us to do, maybe, you know, if they ever finalize it, but, you know, that's not a requirement of the law that the subject line say anything specific. So I did think it was interesting that he raised that at all. And do you guys have any indication why he focused on that?
So this is Leah. I think that he was concerned with the idea that some plaintiffs will not actually receive the validation notice sent in the email. You know, as probably we all know, a lot of emails just get sent directly to the trash without ever being opened. So I believe that the court's concern with the subject line alerting the consumer as to what the contents are about was simply he was concerned that some plaintiffs won't actually get their validation notice at all. But then he noticed that, or at least he in his opinion, and I believe my recollection is he raised this during oral argument, that Ms. Green actually wouldn't have standing to bring that claim because she conceded that she opened the email, and so she had access to the validation notice. And in the opinion, the court does seem to suggest that it, even without the regulations or the CFPB's guidance on the issue, he would recommend, or he would believe, or I think that his if, assuming that the plaintiff does not concede they opened the original email, would the email qualify as the initial communication if it doesn't contain that language? So you would, let's say you send the validation notice in the email, and then it kind of generic header, consumer never opens it. Does that qualify as the initial communication such that you've met your obligation to give the validation notice? And I think the answer, according to this judge, you might decide that it doesn't qualify as the initial communication because it wasn't calculated to give reasonable notice.
Because of the subject line, though. Had correct. The subject line said something like, your bank number one of America account ending in 5423, then he said, you know, when you are getting so many emails in your inbox and you're filtering through them and looking for things that are important to you, that gives the consumer reasonable notice that they should open up that particular email. And it's interesting that you kind of brought up him choosing the CFPB. We brought the CFPB's rules to his attention, and there was a lot of back and forth about whether or not we should do that. So I was wondering if Leah was going to throw me under the bus here because of the fact that while the rules aren't in effect yet, the CFPB does concur that the electronic signature, the eSign Act, does not apply to an initial communication sent by email if the validation notice appears in the body of that email. And so the judge, you know, we were pointing that out to the judge to just point out, well, you know, while there's no case out there that's actually considered this issue, the law itself is pretty clear. And also the CFPB has this opinion. And then the plaintiff brought out, well, the CFPB also has the opinion that you need to have this in the subject line. And theirs did not have this in the subject line. And so that's how we got to that.
So that really question. The genesis of this whole case, though, I mean, it didn't start with True Accord, right? So, I mean, at least in my opinion, it probably started with the Lavallee case, probably back, you know, in the Seventh Circuit, which is where this whole idea of e-sign came up really for the first time relative to the validation notice. And Kelly, I know you and I were watching that case like very closely, and we talked about it a bunch. And you know, in that case, that was another email case where the consumer was provided an email correspondence with a secure package, linked to a secure package, and the content of that email was actually fairly sparse. There really wasn't anything in it because they were trying to validate the person's identity prior to, you know, giving them the information about this debt. And there was a suit filed, you know, based upon the receipt of that email. There was also evidence in the record that the consumer never opened the package, so never got the validation correspondence. And so the question was it effectively given? You know, was the validation notice that was in the secure package appropriate? And the CFPB actually took the time to write an amicus brief. And this was where this whole idea of e-sign came up. And they said, well, you know, we think that, you know, you can provide it electronically in an email, but you have to comply with e-sign. And they didn't comply with e-sign and get the consumer's consent. So as a result, you know, the validation communication is going to be ineffective. So that's when this whole idea of like e-sign first came up, right? With email correspondence. And so that's what started making people take a look at, well, if we're going to be sending email, because email is a future, and well, it's the present, it's not even the future, but that's how most people communicate, right? Email, text, Zoom now. Can't wait for the Zoom debt collection calls to start. So the whole idea was, well, does ESI need to apply? And Kelly, I mean, I know you and I talked about that from the beginning, and it was the same as in this case, is no, it doesn't apply. And so this case finally went through the analysis, because in the Lavallee case, the court didn't actually even have a chance to reach it because they decided it wasn't a communication at all, which was interesting, just because there wasn't enough in the actual communication that would be a communication in connection with the debt. So we never got to it. So here was finally the opportunity to try to convince a court, right, that, you know, e-sign is not applicable. You don't have to go through the hoops of e-sign. And I'm sure there's like a couple of you out there that are like, well, why do we care if we have to go through e-sign or not? It's just difficult. There's a lot of disclosures that you have to provide. There's consents you have to obtain before you're communicating. And it's an unnecessary hassle. And it's not necessarily feasible to get those types of consents from consumers who you're trying to reach in the first place with your initial communication. So it can be very difficult.
And not consumer friendly at the end of the day.
It's really not, nor is it really necessary in today's society, I think, but I digress. The big argument here, right, was that e-sign is not applicable. Well, why? Why would it be? I don't know, Leah, I'm sure you can explain why it's not applicable.
I'm sorry, I was reading one of the comments that we got, or the questions that we got in the question and answer. One of the questions says, does this only apply when the validation notice is in the body of the email and not in a link that the consumer has to follow to actually see the validation notice? And I think my answer to that, and I'll let the other panelists chime in on it, but my answer to that is twofold. One, I would be worried about an overshadowing claim if you have information about paying the debt in the body of the email, then the validation notice can only be found through the link. I don't think that would be a good idea. I think that the best practice would be to put the validation notice in the body of the email, and then you have all the problems regarding e-sign solved right there, because it's in the same communication as the initial communication. So there's no e-sign requirement. Ladies, do you guys have any different thoughts?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I would only add the following. So the CFPB made clear in their rulemaking that they want to see the validation notice in the body of the email. And similar to the case Nicole was just talking about, in Lavallee, the consumer had to click on a link. There was nothing overshadowing in the email because the email didn't even say anything about a debt. It just said, you've received a secure message from MedOne Solutions, click here. And to click on it, you had six more steps to do to actually obtain. You had to enter a password and other information to obtain that the letter that actually had the validation notice in it. The CFPB agrees because if the consumer can readily access that validation notice, it's better for the consumer and easier for the consumer, and you're giving it in the initial communication, because right when they open the email, there's the validation notice right in the body. And so the next question that is in the question list talks about, why is there this assumption that physical mail gets opened, right? Versus, like, does that assumption apply to email? And that's where the court is going. I believe that the court was going in thinking about, well, gee, this consumer opened it. So we don't really have that issue here. So it's not exactly what the court's saying, but it is what the CFPB is saying, is you have to have some sort of reasonable belief that this consumer can access email. And if you have that reasonable belief that this consumer can access email, and you are drawing attention to that email by putting in the subject line that this is about your Capital One debt ending in 5476 or whatever, then you're doing everything you can to provide the consumer the opportunity to go and check out those notices. I'm hoping that that mailbox rule gets applied by a court eventually to email, but we don't have that yet. So it's actually not, it's not written in a statute anywhere. The mailbox rule is something that is created by the courts, that if you're putting it in the mail, it's addressed properly, and you're monitoring your return mail and you don't get a return to sender, then you can assume that the consumer received it. And you don't have to prove that they opened it. If they chose to throw it in the trash, that's on the consumer, not on you, the company.
But you're right, we don't have that rule yet, but I agree, it's probably what the court is thinking about, right? So will there be a time where the mailbox rule will be applicable to email correspondence? Maybe. Maybe that's where it's going, but it's not there now, for sure.
Recall that many emails get filtered out through spam filters. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a difference in how courts treat, at least right now, how courts treat regular mail, which if it's addressed properly, ends up in the consumer's hands and they can do with it what they want, versus email, which either it could be filtered out through spam or through a spam filter. And then like going through your spam filter, you can like, unless it says something about the original creditor or somehow alerts the consumer that this is not simply spam, there's no reason to believe that they would have gotten it into their hand. So I think that there's just a difference between physical mail and email that the courts at least are going to apply in determining whether, you know, you've met your requirement by sending the validation notice via either physical mail or email.
Yeah, there's no real certainty though that mail gets into people's hands either. And so I truly believe that the mailbox rule should apply evenly to emails because, you know, you're getting the email address from the creditor who's providing it to you. Where'd they get it? Oh, the consumer. The consumer gave it to them. Why? Because the consumer prefers emailing with their creditor, prefers getting the notices immediately. I had to buy a house. Well, I didn't have to. I mean, we bought a house yesterday. They had to FedEx me the documents. I had to sign them. I had to FedEx them back. All I wanted to do, I'm like, why can't I DocuSign these? Craziness. Consumers prefer it. And so if you have a sophisticated email deliverability strategy, you are doing everything you can to make sure that your emails are getting delivered into that consumer's inbox and not into their spam box. And you're monitoring hard bounce, soft bounce, open rates, so you know if your email's been opened. We knew that Ms. Green opened our email because what happens is there's a pixel inside the email that renders when the consumer opens up that email. And so, you know, sometimes the email service providers attempt to block that because they don't want, you know, senders to know when their emails have been read. But for the majority, I think it's like 98% effective that if your email says it's been opened, it's actually been opened. Lauren is asking some pretty good questions here. Hi, Lauren. Thanks for sending these in. Should we consider putting something in the subject line like validation notice for creditor name, debit, account number 1235, or something like this? Should we make it obvious that the validation notice is in fact the subject of the email? What issues are there with this approach, guys?
I have a really mixed feeling on the whole subject line thing, and for a couple of reasons. One, obviously the CFPB's rules are not final. So they're not law. They're what they think they're going to do, but again, they're not required. So that's kind of number one. Number two is the more information that you do put in a subject line, you do run the risk of a couple different things, right? Like third-party disclosure, you run the risk that, you know, the subject line itself will be considered a communication if the consumer never clicks on the email. And then do you have a problem because, you know, you can't obviously put all the disclosures you need to disclose into your, you know, your short character subject line? I mean, we've seen stupider claims out there, like they exist. So I'm just very hesitant when I'm making recommendations to clients to do things like that when there is no real legal reason right now to do that. I know the court may like it, but unfortunately, a lot of my clients have gotten dinged trying to do things that ultimately are benefits to consumers, or they're trying to do things to give the consumer more information, like more options to dispute, like, or, you know, waiving the time frame. But if they tell the consumer that, somehow they're still getting sued because, you know, they're not giving the, you know, the exact validation notice or something, when really their intent was to do better. And actually that's what happened to Med One in the Lavallee case, because, you know, you could tell what they were trying to do. They were trying to get the consumer to validate the consumer's information so that they weren't providing protected health information to a third party, you know, anybody that had opened the email, because these were medical debts. And so they were trying to do better, and in doing better, got dinged. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So, and Todd's actually asking a question here where he's saying, well, if you put something like that in the subject line, aren't you going to get a third party disclosure claim?
I've got some thoughts on that. I think that it's different. Like, one person asked, isn't putting or would putting info in the subject line be akin to putting info on the outside of an envelope? And the answer, in my opinion, the answer to that is that the envelope claims are primarily an issue of privacy, because the envelope passes through the hands of various third parties who work in the post office or whatnot. So they're concerned with the privacy of the individual, whereas email theoretically goes straight to the individual, no third parties involved. There's like machines involved, but no like human beings who are going to be seeing the subject line. To the extent someone's seeing the contents of the, like hacking into it, you also have people who could illegally open mail and see what's inside. That's not your fault. There's a difference between the subject line of the email versus the outside of the envelope, just based on the way it's delivered.
But what about shared email addresses? Because that exists. I mean, like, for example, my neighbors, I don't know why they do this. I hope I use this example a lot, so I hope that they're really not on here one day, but they're married. They have a shared email address that's like their last name, 123 or something, and that's their family email address that they use. I wouldn't do it. I like my own email personally, but like same thing with, like, you know, think about Facebook accounts. I'm sure people out there, you know, if they're on Facebook, they have like a shared Facebook that it's, you know, it's the boyfriend and the girlfriend, or the, you know, the husband and the wife. So that stuff still exists out there. Yeah,
for sure. And my counter to that argument, because Nicole and I have had this discussion before, is ultimately that if this consumer has given that email as the email that they want to communicate with their creditor about, then that's on them, because they're already communicating about that account with the creditor in that way. And so I think that, you know, we could certainly say in response to that sort of a claim, well, this is the email you provided. The CFPB addresses that in their rulemaking and indicates that if it is the email that the consumer provided to the creditor that was reasonably recently used by the creditor to email the consumer, then that would be a best practice you could have as an agency to defend against that third-party disclosure claim. The court, I brought up the email envelope, you know, as a suggestion of like, you know, listen, ultimately is the subject line like a envelope disclosure, and he did not find that at all persuasive whatsoever.
I've got a question for the other panelists. I seem to recall either the FDCPA or the Rosenthal Act treats the debtors or the consumer's spouse identically as the consumer. It treats them as one person. So to the extent that there's a shared email address between spouses, I wouldn't, from under the statute, wouldn't that be, you know, the same as disclosing it to the consumer?
Yeah. And that's the situation when they're married. But if, you know, you might have people that, you know, never actually get married, but they're still, I mean, it can exist. I'm not saying it's a huge high risk scenario. And obviously you'd fall back on the bona fide error defense, right? Like, here's why we only email the addresses that we get from the creditors, because we know that, you know, that these are where the consumer wants their communications to go to, and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, very defensible, just things to consider, basically.
And you guys, we're having the best like chatter coming through in both the chat box and the Q&A. Like, who knew you could spend this much time talking about the subject line of one email and the law and debt collection? So Larry Lasky, thank you, Larry, who's always got wicked good comments and questions, has said, what about the fact that if someone is trying to like wiretap, Stored Communication Acts that prohibit interception, of unpermitted access to electronic information, like there's your defense, which kind of Leah had already mentioned to some sort of third party claim when you are sending it through the mail. Larry also asks about formatting the validation notice and meeting those state requirements for font and bold point text. And so this brings up another point in the case that I kind of wanted to address that kind of moves into the overshadowing claims. But I'm going to first pause on this one issue. The court did kind of mention that, you know, there weren't any subsequent reminders about the validation notice in any of the future email communications that she received. There was a dispute, this debt link that appears in the footer of all TrueAccord emails. Now, the footer of all TrueAccord emails is formatted in a particular way to make sure that every single email has our address, our phone number, our hours of operation, our privacy policy. And so the judge said, you know, seemingly buried at the bottom of the emails, well, no, it's our footer intended to have all this information to meet our state law requirements. But since he's thinking that I'm burying the dispute, this debt link in the bottom, now I'm thinking, well, maybe I need to move the dispute, the debt link up into some sort of a footer. And I got this idea yesterday while eating lunch, so I wrote it on a napkin. Maybe I need to write, you know, some sort of reminder in the top that says something about your rights reminder that will appear on any email sent during the first 30 days that will send them to a page that reminds them of what their rights are and has some sort of disclaimer, you know, that we've designed after the Third Circuit cases and, you know, relating to whether or not you can dispute orally or verbally, and says, you know, something like, while you may have different rights in the jurisdiction where you live, TrueAccord allows you to dispute this debt at any point. And if you dispute, we'll pause it. And here's the validation notice that we were required, that we gave you in your initial communication. And then we like put it there. What do you guys think about that?
I just like that Tim Collins just commented here that said that will surely get us sued. Ha ha.
Okay, so my boss doesn't like that idea. But I really think it's a good idea, Tim. So anyways.
I think you can do it if you word it appropriately. I don't know that you need it. I know, again, you know, that may be something that the judge, I read the opinion, I saw that, but I mean, he seems to be commenting on it. But again, is it material? It wasn't material to his analysis. So I think once you start giving the validation, I think it may be hard to craft a disclaimer because of it runs from a certain time period that you may have some issues formulating the appropriate language, but it is doable if you can, you know, figure out a way to draft it appropriately. I just don't know that it's needed. I don't know. I'm very much like, again, I've just seen my clients get sued too many times for doing things that they tried to do to make the consumers' lives easier. And so I take a less is more approach sometimes when things like that come up.
Do you agree, Leah? It seems like a lot of people in the chat box agree.
Well, I think Nicole's point that you have to be careful drafting it is well taken. I would not simply repeat the validation notice because that would restate the 30-day right to validate and cause all kinds of problems. You could draft something along the lines of, and it might vary by context, so, you know, think about it, but not something along the lines of nothing in this email or that nothing here, you know, nothing here. You still have the right to validate the debt within 30 days of the initial communication, or leave out the 30 days. You still have the right to dispute the debt or obtain validation. Click here if you would like to do so. Something like that. You know, I mean, think of it in terms of just as a reminder that they still have the right to validate during the validation period, and nothing in this email does away with that right.
I like Pamela Dotson's suggestion here. which says something very, very generic, and that says nothing in this communication alters any rights described to you in prior communications. I like that because, again, less is more. It's like, yeah. I just referred you back to my original communications that you can now go through and figure out what they mean, because now I'm not making any type of misstatements. I'm not inadvertently restarting the validation period, which I can't do anyway and would get sued for. So, I like that. I like that approach better.
Yeah.
All right. So then, thank you, Pamela. I'm writing down what you are saying here in the chat box. See it soon on a TrueRecord email, folks. let's move into overshadowing an email. Leah, I was hoping you could kind of explain the difference between overshadowing claims that occur in the courts around your first communication versus the overshadowing cases that occur in your subsequent communications, rapidly enough so that we can also get to First Amendment, which is super fascinating. And then we can go into volume.
Yeah, so the concept, which I picked up doing, looking at all the case law, and it might not be a big surprise to anybody here, but overshadowing analysis focusing on initial communications talks about two different issues. One is a request for payment, even if it's not asking for payment within 30 days, is it made more prominent than the validation notice? Now, if so, that could give rise to an overshadowing claim. And the second is, is there something in the communication that contradicts the consumer's right to validate the debt or obtain validation or dispute the debt within 30 days? So something that demands payment within the 30-day time period plus some kind of urgency. So you've got those two different types of claims. The one, the overshadowing, what I think of as more of a pure overshadowing claim would be looking at font sizes, colors, comparing it to the validation period or the validation notice to see if more emphasis is placed on a request to pay than it is on the validation notice, like the consumer's validation rights. And so the placement of the validation notice would come into play for that analysis, the color, the font size compared to other fonts in the letter. Go ahead.
Or email,
correct. The communication.
Yeah.
The communication. And then the second type of overshadowing analysis would be looking at subsequent communications. And in those cases, the font size doesn't really come into play unless it's emphasizing an urgency to do something within the 30-day validation period, such as pay. So those cases, the cases looking at subsequent communications, really focus more on whether there's something that contradicts the consumer's right to dispute the debt or obtain verification of the debt within 30-day validation period. So things like pay today that's given some kind of urgency, like a threat to sue or a threat to do credit reporting if you don't pay within the 30-day validation period. Obviously, anything that directly contradicts their rights to validate, such as, the case that where the debt collector said, you haven't disputed this debt, therefore we now deem it valid when they still had some more time to dispute the debt within the validation period, things like that. So there's a little bit of a different type of analysis that goes into the two types of claims.
Yeah, and what was interesting is when we were talking about this with the court as he was looking at email, because this is the first case dealing with email and overshadowing. And unlike call and collect, where you might be calling people during the 30-day validation period, that's on a recording somewhere, but there aren't many cases that I found out there where those call recordings are brought in as a part of an overshadowing case. They're typically looking at letters that were sent during the validation period. And so when you're sending emails during the validation period, and there's no, restrictions in the CFPB rule on the number of emails that you send in a given time period, because there doesn't have to be. It's regulated by the market, right? If you're oversending emails, you're going to be shut down because the email service providers are going to think that you are a mass marketer and they're going to tag you as spam. And then you're never going to be able to get that email into the consumer's inbox. So, you know, they're going to look at every single piece of communication that you send during that validation period with the intent of determining whether or not they can make an overshadowing claim, because it's in writing. It's there, you know, and so it's definitely something that you need to think very critically about when you are sending emails. And the court got into the volume question sort of on his own, really. I think he brought up that idea, and he wanted to know whether or not 6 emails, as was alleged in the complaint, because this motion to dismiss was simply based on the complaint itself, 6 emails in and of themselves were overshadowing because they were being sent during the validation notice. They included links where a consumer could go and pay, just as many links as a consumer could go and dispute this debt, although those were at the bottom of the email. And so he included the text of all of those emails in his opinion, which I think was very helpful. And you can see all of the emails, they were attached as exhibits in the lawsuit itself. So Leah, how did that go?
So I thought that it went really well, although even in the opinion, the court leaves open the idea that the number, the volume, frequency of the emails could be a factor, but ultimately it stuck with the case law that holds that you have to look at the contents of the subsequent communications to see whether they demand payment or some other, make a demand that the consumer do something contrary to their right to validate or to dispute the debt within the 30-day period. So like a demand for payment now that's emphasized repeatedly, or you know, something that threatens the consumer if they don't pay at some point within the 30-day period. While the court did leave it open, he was like, it's not that it could never be a factor, but looking at the contents of these emails, none of which demand a payment within the 30-day validation period, and all which were pretty benign, there was no overshadowing.
The messages were like very polite too and helpful. And I'm sure that was something that I'm sure weighed in his reasoning too, because I mean, if you read what the communications actually were, they were very polite, very helpful. You know, if they had been like aggressive or, had a different tone, it's possible that he could have ruled differently. So, but again, I agree, Leah, and it's totally content. Content has to be a factor. I just don't see how you could have a pure overshadowing claim based upon the volume of 6 emails over a 30-day period. When Kelly told me they were making this argument, not to get into attorney-client privilege, but you know, my response was, what? Like, that misunderstands the whole concept behind overshadowing, right? That's not what the statute intended. It's, you know, obviously some type of communication to the consumer that dispels their rights house or confuses the consumer about how to act.
Well, I got out my trusty FDCPA, which I keep close at hand at all times, right, to go to the statute, which I didn't have sitting next to me at the actual argument, which was really rather unfortunate. But the statute itself suggests that it uses the conjunction and. So it's collection activity and communication, which in the supplemental briefs filed last week, just a week before the decision came out, addressed only that issue. And Leah did the research first, and we only came up with 2 cases where the word volume was mentioned as something that was, you know, argued by the plaintiff, hey, the volume, you know, alone, but the volume were like 2 letters. In both of the cases, it involved 2 letters that were sent to the consumer. So, I mean, really 1 is enough to be a violation if it's overshadowing. So it really does hinge on what is the content of that communication. Okay, so I was going to move into, you know, some of the other exciting issues, but we do have some questions here that I think is really important for us to touch on relating to best practices for acquiring email addresses. So thanks to the many people who have asked this question a couple of different ways, because folks also mentioned like, hey, I'm pretty sure you can get you know, an email scrub from different entities out there where you could you know, check best practices for email. And one person mentioned, you know, judgments could be like, you know, 15 years old and people change their emails over time. No, I disagree. People, not with the judgment part, but people don't change their email addresses over time. I've had the same email address for a very, very long time. That's one of the points that we sort of talked about in the CFPB. It would be very interesting for there to be a consumer study of this. There is information out there about consumers creating special email accounts just for their banking and online activity needs. So that's true, but that's like creating one special email account for that and then using that email for a long period of time. So you can scrub to get people's emails, and you should definitely, as part of an email deliverability strategy, which our team is very good at, and I can't speak very articulately about it. I just know they're super bright people. Ultimately, you need to be able to check before you send an email whether or not that email is going to bounce. And so having the capability to do that or partnering with someone who can is important, because you want to keep your rating high so that you don't get tagged as a spammer. But that part aside, note that the CFPB has three sort of rules that they have established in their rules if they ever come to become rules we must follow. Hopefully they do, and really soon, about whether, you know, making sure that when you are sending emails, that you have a reasonable belief, and emails with required disclosures, because there's no requirement to have consent to send an email at all, unless there's some sort of writing that you are sending to them. That's when eSign kicks in. Someone else kind of asked a question about this. So if you've sent the validation notice by mail, you don't need any consent to be emailing with the consumer after that. If your initial communication contains the validation notice, also except for New York. If Nicole's about to say except for New York, I can see it in her face. Look, we've known each other so long, she's gonna say except for New York. But anyways, if your initial communication has it in the body, then you're meeting that requirement in the FDCPA that if you're giving it in your initial communication, then you don't have to give it to them within 5 days in writing, because you gave it, you satisfied the statute in your first communication. So anyways, back to, you know, how do you get the email? What are the best practices? I would say take a look at the rule, just to give yourself an idea of what the regulators are thinking about, and the rule as it relates to third-party disclosures, because it talks about the reasonableness of interpreting that someone's email.
I'll just add, though, that I do disagree on the changing of your email addresses, because, I mean, I can give you the example of the boyfriend-girlfriend thing again, and then they break up, and then the email address. Sure. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. It happens. But also, remember now that kids are getting into email a lot earlier than they did in the past, right? So, you know, the child's first email address, which they may have used, you know, set up when they're 14, and then now they're 23 and they don't want to use, you know, froggy101@gmail.com anymore, and they want to create a different email address. Because, and I'm only thinking about this because I was a child during the AOL heyday, and I had an AOL email address that was like sunshine100 or something like that, which obviously I don't use anymore, but I had that, I feel like, until I maybe was in college. So, you know,
if I was going to send you an email at your froggy101@aol.com that you chose when you were a youth, right? Back then, that email is no longer valid. It would bounce. back to me. And so I would know. I'm sorry?
Unless somebody else took it.
The email service providers don't allow that to happen at this time.
Like it never, like you can't have some, like if somebody relinquishes an address, it doesn't happen?
It is my understanding that they do not. And I can get back to you by talking to my internal smarty pants people that know the real answer to that. But I'm pretty sure they've told me that the email service providers don't let people, which is why like John Stevens, my husband, who's a John Stevens, is like John Stevens number 465, you know, at gmail.com because the first, you know, 464 were taken. But yeah, for sure. You'd know that bounces.
Are we getting cracking up on the comments here? Like they're cracking me up on the chat box. Tim Collins still has his AOL email address. Apparently he uses that all the time. Apparently I've been found out by others, my secret AOL address.
All right. Very good. So does anybody else have, thoughts on best practices for, emails, email scrubbing? There's no email scrub to determine like right now, like, oh, has the consumer updated? Well, I mean, I guess there technically is because you can scrub to determine like, hey, is this somebody's email?
I just think that's putting your policies in writing, right? So like it's more important when you're thinking about, you know, potential risk, like document how it is that you determine that you're going to send an email to a particular address. Either, you know, we get it from the creditor, or here's the ways that we try to make sure that we're only sending it to the proper person, because that's going to be what's going to save you in the end. Either, you know, if you inadvertently make a mistake and somebody gets an email that they're not supposed to get or something, you know, have something to point back to that you could show a judge or, you know, a jury, like, look how much we care. Here's what we do. And, you know, that's all designed, you know, with the purpose of, you know, making sure that our communications, our polite and lovely communications that are not threatening at all, go to the right person. And, I mean, that's going to be the most important thing you can do. And it's easy. It's a one pager, you know, that's my advice.
All right. Then I think we should move on, to, some of the interesting things that nobody might know about, except for, the folks, here, that occurred in this case. So the first one is plaintiff, who was the named plaintiff in a class action lawsuit, lived in Nevada and asserted violations of the Rosenthal Act. So we had a whole section in our brief that she's from Nevada. She can't bring claims. She has no standing. What are your thoughts on that, ladies?
Super interesting. Go ahead, Leah.
Yeah, so based on the case law that I had reviewed regarding this issue, unless the case law leaves open the possibility that if activity originates from within the state, then it's possible that you could assert a claim under the Rosenthal Act. But she didn't allege that. She said that Crewcord's headquarters are here, therefore Rosenthal Act applies, which courts have found is not enough. I don't know that even having activity originating within the state will necessarily confer standing to the consumer under, depending on what the statute provides, because a lot of these are consumer protection statutes. They're aimed at protecting the in-state consumers. So to the extent that the consumer is not in-state, the statute itself may not be intended to apply to the consumer. I know Nicole had some ideas about this. Nicole?
Well, I think when you're thinking about standing, which we talk about a lot now that we never used to talk about in this area of defense, but obviously since Spokio and other issues that this comes up more often now, what gives the consumer the right to bring a particular claim, right? And for those of you out there that aren't lawyers or don't know, the Rosenthal Act is a California statute. So it's a California state law. And, you know, the plaintiff is a Nevada resident. So the question kind of arises, well, what right does this person that, you know, is partying in Vegas every day have to come into California and try to enforce California's laws that were probably, you know, most likely made to protect California, not, you know, a Nevada resident. So I think when you look at it, you have to look at the injury in fact analysis, number one, to see, look at standing. And then second, you know, whether this consumer is within the zone of interests that this the statute was designed to protect. Like, it's kind of like a two-prong analysis, right? I think many times, and I think this may have been ultimately what the result would have been in California, because I feel like California is just super consumer protection in a lot of ways, is that I think ultimately the court probably would have said that she could assert it based upon the fact that, you know, at least according to, I assume what the complaint said, that, you know, there would be activity that was originating from California directed at others. And I think California is going to think that they have an interest in regulating the business conduct that's going on in their borders. So while she may not be the consumer, I think it probably in this particular instance, she could have made a pretty good argument to enforce the act. Now, I know there's other facts out there that, like, where the activity originated, blah, blah, blah.
That is craziness. That just makes me sad as a person. And I'm sure that my mom is smiling and thinking, ha, you are becoming more conservative every day as a result of these, you know, liberal states.
Shout out to your mom, Kelly, first of all. Practices. You need to give a shout out to Sue Nepper out there.
Hi, Sue Nepper. Thanks for coming. That's too bad if that's the case. Because I thought for sure that that was going to be a solid defense, at least to the class claim, was that she is a consumer living in Nevada. How is she bringing this class claim under California law?
Well, you do, and you do have, it does get more complicated, I think, when you're thinking about her adequacy as a class representative. But I think that's probably how it would have shaken out. Now, I will say in other states, it could go completely differently. And this is not the first time I've seen this either. Like, this has occurred before, where I even saw it where I had a case in Illinois district court where a Missouri consumer was trying to assert the Missouri Merchandising Practices Act in Illinois, in the Illinois district court. So the Illinois federal court was being asked to enforce the laws of another state, which is even stranger to me. But these types of things come up from time to time. But it's super interesting constitutional issue that, you know, we don't always get to deal with. So I like it.
All right. So speaking of constitutional issue, I'm so sorry, Leah, that we've saved 2 minutes for my favorite reasoning or argument that we made in our briefs that were never actually heard by the court, which I met Leah on an airplane, everyone. And I'm pretty sure that when we first met, because it was a long ride from California to Florida, we got into Leah's theory about how the FDCPA violates the First Amendment. And she said, I'm just waiting for a case, I'm just waiting for a case where I can make this argument. And I tried to give her that case. But interestingly, courts don't really want to take up massive First Amendment arguments that would invalidate the entirety of the statute. So it gives courts a reason to really consider the other motions to dismiss and get the case off their docket. So it really was a great argument. Leah, why don't you tell our remaining viewers about it?
Right. So it's not just a reluctance by the courts to decide First Amendment issues. They have an obligation to first consider whether they can grant the motion on any other ground before reaching the constitutional issue. So, you know, and I made that point, you know, in the brief, you know, we think that we win this on all these other grounds, so you're probably not going to get here. But to the extent that you do, we believe these statutes are unconstitutional under the First and 14th Amendment. Now, you know, it's an issue that hasn't actually been raised. And people, you know, the First Amendment has been raised before, but not this particular argument, which is a viewpoint discrimination argument, which under more recent Supreme Court case law, they make clear that even commercial speech, if the commercial speech regulation engages in viewpoint discrimination, the statute may be, it is presumptively unconstitutional.
Is that the same as content-based, viewpoint-based?
It's a little bit different because all commercial speech regulation is content-based, because it's focused on a category of speech, and it's looking at the contents of that speech and regulating it. So all, you know, to the extent that it's commercial speech, you know, courts look at it a little bit differently because they don't want to invalidate all these commercial speech regulations, which, for instance, it prohibits sellers of merchandise from making false advertising claims. And it, you know, it can be, you know, they don't have to jump through the hoops that other regulations would have to from a First Amendment standpoint. They give that kind of regulation more deference. But here, you know, my point that I raised in the brief is that consumers and debt collectors are actually standing in the same footing. They're both, you know, to the extent that the debt collector is, you know, the current owner of the debt, is an even better fact situation, which TrueCourt can't make. But it's talking as a basically an agent of the original debt, of the original, or not the original creditor, but the current owner. The two parties are both have rights in a contract. It's a contract dispute. And the statute is picking sides between two parties to basically what's just a contract dispute and creating different playing rules about who can say what. The consumer can say anything they want. They don't have to worry about liability under the FDCPA or Rosenthal Act. The debt collector cannot. It has to worry about strict liability. So it changes the rules for speaking for these two parties. That is viewpoint discrimination. It's choosing sides in a dispute between two parties. That is constitutional, unless it can survive strict scrutiny, which the FDCPA does not.
So that's super interesting. And you'd probably enjoy if you didn't watch the oral argument on Barr versus the American Political Consultants case, the TCPA case that's on, that went to oral argument a couple weeks ago, because that's the analysis that the court had to go through when it was trying to determine if the exemption for student loans is unconstitutional restriction on content-based speech, and went through the whole strict scrutiny thing. And super interesting. I did a cool Slack chat for Mike on that after listening to the argument. But if you haven't listened to it, I would recommend.
No, I haven't listened to it, but I will. I wouldn't mind it if you sent me a link via email.
I will.
It's something that, frankly, I think some people think I'm crazy, but I feel very passionately about it. I've given it a lot of thought, and I just, I'm really looking forward to a court having the courage first they'd have to find a violation of the act before they could reach the constitutional issue, mm-hmm. or at least a potential violation of the act. They'd have to determine, we can't decide this issue on a motion to dismiss because there are facts at issue. So we have to move on to the constitutional argument if it was a pleadings-based motion. So, hey, if you've got a case, let me know if there looks like potential liability.
Oh, it looks like Britt sent the link. Hey, Britt. It's right there, so you can click on it.
Wasn't that the flush heard around the world? Wasn't that the case where someone flushed the toilet?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
That happened like 2 days or the day before Leah and I had our Zoom oral argument with the court in the Green case. And I made sure to not sit anywhere near a bathroom.
Yeah, that was quite funny. I mean, a lot of things. Clarence Thomas actually talked. I mean, there's a lot of things that happened during that oral argument. So,
well, I really appreciate Leah, you representing us in this case. Nicole, you being my person that I always go to first. I really am lucky that I was going to NARCA and just happened to sit next to Leah. Because your advocacy was excellent. So thanks for joining me to talk about this. Thanks, Mike Gibb, for having us. Thanks all of you who tuned in on your start to the Labor Day weekend. I wish you all a very pleasant time. Happy to keep talking about email. If you guys have questions, please reach out. I did reach out to my team to determine. I know that Gmail does not reuse. That's what I heard back. Gmail does not reuse names, we don't think. We're not sure with Yahoo and Hotmail, but I'm going to figure it out for you. Unfortunately, our number one person on this happens to be on vacation today, so he's not responding.
And if anyone has any questions that we didn't answer, I'm sure everyone would be happy to if you want to shoot us emails or whatever. We love to talk about this stuff. Yeah. All day.
Someone asked me to talk about the chicken. I'm in my son's room, hence the Star Wars theme here with some art project that he did for school, because my house is being renovated and there were people in my other space. So here we are. Hello. Thanks for coming.
Well, let me jump back in and thank you, Kelly, for coming up with this idea and turning this around on such short notice. You'll see an email in your inbox if you haven't noticed it already from me, looking for more, wanting to do another one of these next week. Because I think there are so many questions that we didn't get a chance and so many topics or issues that we could probably spend more time on. So hopefully we'll come back with more webinars on this in the very near future. But Nicole, Leah, Kelly, thank you so much. This was a great discussion. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having us. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody. Bye.
Have a happy weekend.
Stay safe. Have a great weekend. We'll be back soon. Take care.